Edmar Castañeda with Afro Horrible. He's a jazz and I could call him a traditional harpist. And this is from his 2005 album, Cuarto de Colores, Room of Colors. I'm really delighted to have him with us today. It relates to the latter part of our program, especially. This is Lead Stories. I'm your Trace Lead. And we have a very interesting development politically. We have Mr. Sanders. We have Mr. Sanders declaring his candidacy for president in the upcoming presidential elections. First of all, what do you think about that? Bernie Sanders, having gone through what you know he has gone through, and making an announcement that he has not given up on that goal, that he is seeking to be president of the United States once again. The field is getting fuller and fuller, and there he is. What do you make of this candidacy? Will it work? Well, I'll tell you, he's gotten some very good indications, even this early in the game. He raised almost $6 million in donations at a rate of an average of $27, but it almost reached the $6 million mark. That's very impressive. Just after announcing, and within just a matter of hours, this is the kind of response that he got financially. People sending in their donations at the rate of $27 an hour. $27 per donation, I should say. It was exactly the same approach that he had when he ran the last time. So, 888-874-4888. What do you think of Bernie Sanders' declaration that he's running? How do you think it will affect the race as a whole, other candidates, other Democrats, especially? He's running not as a Democrat, he's running as a progressive, as an independent. So, what does that say to you about the way the candidacy is shaping up and whether it will cause any kind of a friction with the Democrats? As you know, although Sanders is an independent from Vermont, senator from Vermont, he has traditionally caucused with Democrats, but he is pretty clear he's not running as a Democrat. He's running as an independent. And what does that say about the potential within the whole group of candidates? What does that say about his potential for making a very significant stride? 888-874-4888. We have Ma'at. You're on the air.
Yes, greetings to the beloved family.
Thank you.
That I wasn't aware of course, excuse me. Of course, I heard announcement. However, I didn't hear that he is running as an independent. Is that so?
Well, he's not running as a Democrat, and he has been a progressive, so I don't know that he is explicit about running as an independent candidate, but it appears that that is what it is. He'll have to clarify that.
Yes, well, that's a very interesting point because as much as we would have loved to have Ralph Nader as president, boy, he could have straightened out a lot of things. You know what happened in Florida, the votes that went to him put, what's his face, Bush over the line. So that's a concern. I'll hold off on that until that's further clarified. But I love Bernie. hadn't voted in a while, and during the primaries in New York, I got out there and I voted, you know.
Why am I getting, I don't know, you're in and out.
Well, what I'm trying to say is that...
Let me ask you, are you getting any feedback on your line that from time to time your voice just disappears?
Oh, I didn't know that's what you were saying. Can you hear me? Can you hear me now?
Oh, yes. Yes,
okay.
I can hear you, but I could also hear that there are some interruptions as if somebody's calling in on your line.
No, there's just those gremlins that prance around. But I say, in certain respects, the more the merrier. That's why I brought up Marion Williamson, who has not only the progressive policies, I mean, she's got the solutions, including how to...
people. You do this all the time. We're talking about Bernie.
I understand that. I'm excited about Bernie. But he has to work with the black experience more. He has to hone that aspect. Because I remember in 2016, I heard him talk about police encounters and saying, using the term apprehension. In terms of the police dealing with black people, I mean, that shouldn't even be in the vocabulary, you know, since it's become such a toxic mix. But one of the interesting things about Bernie is that he's from 2016, he's really set the agenda that's become mainstream for Democrats and Medicare for all / single payer, because they're two different things, actually. Free public college tuition.
I would like, you know, it's kind of early yet, because not even he has identified the platform that he will be running on. I'm just looking for a broader understanding, excuse me, of what you make of the candidacy. Just that alone. What do you make of a candidacy of Bernie Sanders in a field that is filling up pretty fast? The Democrats are pretty enthusiastic about taking on Donald Trump. Bernie Sanders is an older candidate. He may soon be joined by Joe Biden. We don't know. But what do you make of his chances, and what do you make of his entry into the race, how it might affect everything else?
Well, the aspect of age stands out, because this is sort of his last go-round to be viable. And, of course, this country tends to be very ageist, but he's actually second in popularity, and it has a lot to do with name recognition, you know, in terms of the favorability of candidates. He's just below. And to me, I'm not crazy about Biden over Sanders, because Sanders, to me, is much, much more progressive and on point.
All right. Well, thank you. And that's what we're looking for. I mean, we have no idea how this would go. He just announced yesterday, last night, as a matter of fact. And what we try to do is just get a sense, an immediate reaction. We have no idea whether what we're saying will hold, because this is a very fluid situation. But it is worthy of observation and comment. Because we know what the situation is with the presidential race as a whole. We know that it is a very, very precarious moment in history. The president himself is under tremendous pressure. The Republicans are under tremendous pressure. The Democrats are under tremendous pressure. Here we have a person coming forward even after we've had the a brief excitement about Kamala Harris and some of the other candidates who already have announced. But Bernie Sanders announcing and getting this incredible initial reaction in terms of donations. And if you can raise $6 million in a matter of hours on the basis of $27 per donation, it is saying something. What do you think that something is? And how do you think it would affect the race as it goes? We don't know what the future holds. We're just prognosticating. From Maryland, Jean, you're on the air.
Hi, you trees.
Hi.
Calling you from snowy Maryland this afternoon.
Ah, that's true. You guys are getting blanketed.
Well, it's not so bad, and it's pretty much over now, but it did snow a little bit. It shut everything down. So, you're talking about Bernie today.
Yes, well, I'm talking about Bernie now, the first half, and then we move on to the other part of our program.
Okay, so let me give you my 3 cents on Bernie. I would suggest that anyone who knows a little bit about civics would understand that the primary process of the voting exercise is owned and operated by the parties, and that the Democratic Party should not be expected, nor are they obligated, to open the door and welcome an independent into that process. And so, thinking of it in those terms, I'd suggest that Bernie is a fraud. And the
Oh,
fact that he's
wow.
popular,
That's pretty rough to call him a fraud.
I say that for a reason, and I don't say it lightly. If Bernie wants to run as a Democrat, he needs to register as a Democrat, become
Right,
a
but he
part of
clearly doesn't want to run as a Democrat because
Yes,
he
I
has not
understand
registered
that.
as a Democrat.
I accept all of that, but that's why I say he's a fraud, because he's walking around having all of his supporters feel that he should be supported by the Democrats in a party process. That's
All
wrong.
right, but regardless of how people may feel about that, the fact is that he has maintained a distance from the Democratic Party when it comes to political identification. He's been pretty consistent with that. So I don't know that I agree with the assessment that he is trying to be a wolf in sheep's clothing. You know,
No,
I
I'm sorry,
think
you're
he
missing
is
my
who
point.
he is.
Please don't miss my point. What I'm saying is that his expectation and the expectation of his supporters that the Democrats, the Democratic Party, is going to give him a fair shake in the primary process, which is owned and operated by Democrats. Now, if you'll recall, last go round, the Democrats cheated him straight up. When Iowa was completed, he and Hillary were at a dead tie. They went to New Hampshire. He cleaned up in New Hampshire. Every report coming out of New Hampshire said that Hillary Clinton was ahead. They used the superdelegates to cheat him. And there is absolutely no reason to expect that they won't do that again. He is not a
Okay,
Democrat.
well, you're raising a legitimate point here about what is likely to dog him again as he runs again. And that is, it is unclear what exactly Bernie is. It is unclear what family he belongs to and how people would react to him. And that is a very interesting point because one would have thought, or one would think, that having gone through this identity crisis, a kind of confusion over whether he's a Democrat or whether he's an independent or whether he's progressive, what exactly is Bernie Sanders? I talked about it a lot on this program, and it remains, I think you're hinting at that it will also haunt him this time around, more than likely.
I really want to just drive home with you before I leave is the idea that the Democrats are not obligated to service anybody that is not a Democrat. And so to expect that Bernie's going to have big results in a Democratic primary is us being silly and him being a fraud.
All right. That's your view. Thank you for it, and thank you for contributing. Gwen from New York, how does Bernie Sanders' announcement that he is going to run again, how did that hit you?
Okay. Just two things I want to say is that I will get to Bernie, but I also, because it's so freezing cold and snowing up here, and I just got back from my first protest for Venezuela in front of Chuck Schumer's office, and I just wanted to give you a briefing on that if you are okay with that, because I thought that was kind of important also. But with regards to Bernie, I think I told everybody I worked my head off for the Bernie Sanders campaign. And while I was doing it, it was a work. I've never worked on any presidential campaign, and it was a work of inspiration for me while it was going on, and deep, deep disappointment and anger when the Democratic Party would not allow him to get a fair shake, or well, basically they rigged the election for the primary. But I don't know if that's a reason for me personally to not fight that system back. I think that's a unfair system, and I as a citizen, feel like I don't want to capitulate to their tricks. And people, you know, when they walk away, they are capitulating. They're saying, okay, we can't fight you. We're going to walk away. So I don't know. I myself, I'm going to continue to fight for anything that I think is fair. And as far as Bernie's announcement, I'm not surprised that he was running. I pretty much expected that he was going to run again. I've looked at all the other contenders so far. And, you know, the reason why I do think he has a better chance is there's one thing that Bernie is not, and he's not Donald Trump. And he's not even close to being Donald Trump. And you still have a lot of people over here, although angry and disappointed at the outcome of things, could be energized again with Bernie Sanders and his run. I think that right now the field, the selection of who's running for the Democratic ticket right now is like a yawn a second. So for me, Bernie was the first one out of the barn with these ideas, which makes him more genuine to me. Everybody else, it's easy to latch on after somebody puts these ideas out there first. So everybody else is latching on to them. But he was the first one to put his toe in the water, and he's the first one that got his head lopped off when he tried to do it, too. So I think because of that, and having the courage to do that, he's probably going to be my first choice again in this, unless somebody else, you know, stunning comes up. I mean, I don't have...
It's early in the game, so I'm just asking, what are our visceral reactions with his announcement coming just yesterday?
Therese, can I just tell you one last thing about I just want to tell you that we were in front of Chuck Schumer's office, and I thought it was pretty stunning that Schumer said that we are a small group, and it was pouring snow out there, and we were told we were not even let to step foot in the building, that it was a private building. And then the man said, well, you have to call him. So I called the office, and the assistant was very nice to me, and he almost let us come up. And so as I was standing there waiting, the police come over, and then he comes back, and he completely flipped his tone with me on the phone. He was completely different. And I told him that I felt that Schumer should understand that, you know, and I believe this is going to be a problem for the Democratic Party if he continues to endorse this war on Venezuela with Donald Trump. He's going to lose a lot of people, and it's a really bad direction for the Democrats to go in. And I'll tell you one thing, going into this presidential nomination, I am looking to see those people that are supporting this illegal war in Venezuela, and I hope other people do too.
All right. Thank you. David, you have the last comment on this segment of what is your visceral reaction to the announcement by Bernie Sanders that he's going to run?
Well, as I look at this, Bernie Sanders is playing the game. And he looks forward to some remote possibility of becoming president. Now, I look at it in terms of the presidency as the subjects, like on the slave plantation, deciding who is the best overseer. Because those who rule, and that means the oligarchs at top, and their minions that are in the Republican and Democrat Party, only let those people who are in harmony with their mission of the U.S. capitalism going forward and doing the things that they want done. So you can say all you want about single-payer health insurance and things like that that would decimate the insurance companies and whatnot. But those people that run those corporations and this fascist system we live in are not going to let any one of those 10 or so new candidates get by after they are vetted and they feel that these people are not down with the interests of the corporate ruling class. So the only person you're going to get is someone who is in harmony with the needs of the corporations that run the country. So Bernie can talk about single payer and all that sort of thing, but that doesn't mean that the people in charge want that to happen. They don't. So, you know, Bernie has some very regressive attitudes in international politics and empire and so forth. And, you know, he called Colonel Gaddafi a thug and all that sort of thing. So, you know, he can talk about things that people are interested in, but those who rule don't want those things for the people. They want the status quo. So the only way that anyone, including Bernie, can get to that person, that place of being on the ballot and being a viable candidate, if they have been vetted and approved by those who rule. That's the way I think about Bernie.
All right, thank you. Well, he just declared yesterday, and there are more to come. I'm sure there are more candidates who will be declaring. But it is an interesting development, which we will follow. And we'll see where Bernie is headed, whether he has learned anything from his last run, whether he's proposing to do anything differently this time. So we'll see. But thank you so much for your assessments. We'll take this break and come back to our Black History Month program. The madness in Washington notwithstanding, we're going to proceed with our program right after this. Harpist Edmar Castañeda with Afro Joropo from his album Cuarto de Colores. This is Lead Stories. You're listening to PRN.FM, and we are going to continue our program with this entry or this offering from my very, very dear friend who has passed away, but who as an academician, a historian, an activist from Guyana, loomed large in the field of people power, moving people through excellent education and information. As I said, he was a very, very dear friend of mine. And I just wanted to share with you a talk that he gave in Brooklyn many years ago, in which he relates a remarkable chapter in U.S. history, erroneously called the Seminole Wars. And it's a short enough piece, it's almost about half an hour or so, but I guarantee you, we have not heard this interpretation of that period of history. And hopefully it will encourage us and encourage us all to do some more reading about this period, especially from the perspective that he's about to share with us today. Professor Jan Carew.
Things about white historiography, this Eurocentric historiography, it hones in always on the things that separate us. They separate us from ourselves. They separate us from our ancestors, from our history, from our families. They divide us up into little fragments. And they never tell you about the unities in struggle that took place in history. And so my historiography hones in just on this point. Because the logic of the situation is that if people were oppressed, like the Native Americans were, and the African ancestors were, obviously they resisted the oppression. And obviously, as intelligent human beings, it occurred to them that by uniting against a common foe, they would have greater strength in the struggle. But the histories lie there waiting generation after generation. And then I pick up the books by Boyd Thatcher, who is a great admirer of Columbus. But in those books I find that in 1502, there is a rebellion, a major rebellion, in which blacks and Native Americans join forces. 1492 to 1502. That's 10 years. And in that time begins a struggle. And you're going to find this uniting of the oppressed threading its way through the entire history for five centuries. And one of the great epics of the struggle took place in, of all places, in Florida. Now, we have black studies departments all over the country, and do you know, I have seen not one single piece about this to train our children, because the way you defeat someone, you defeat them in the mind first. That's why Garvey said, first you must change your way of thinking, and then peacefully carve up the weapons with which to fight. So they assault the mind. They tell you about rebellions that Nat Turner and Denmark Vesey and Posner. But if you notice, all of them were betrayed. They didn't win. And the one great insurgency that blacks fought in this country for over 130 years is one of the best kept secrets in black history. And it took place in Florida. And you read about it as the Seminole Wars. You've heard about that, haven't you? Seminole Wars? Do you know that there's no such thing as a Seminole? Seminole doesn't exist. Seminole was a Creek word for runways. and those slaves who escaped from the Carolinas and from Virginia down through what eventually became Georgia. Georgia became a state to block the movement of escaped slaves into Florida. Did you know that? That's how it, they set it up as, in quotes, a free state. And there in Florida, the blacks were called Seminoles first, the black escapees who went into Florida, who were welcomed by the Native Americans there. And there you had some of the most interesting Native Americans in the entire hemisphere. There was a group called the Calusas, and the Tequestas, and the Apalaches, and even their enemies write about them with respect, because they were some really bad Native Americans. I mean, they... When Ponce de Leon came, and you know we have at the Exploratorium a film on Cabeza de Vaca, who went with the Narvaez expedition, and I'm going to, interesting to see how they're going to do this film. How I learned about the resistance there in Florida is that you have to read a book by a half Native American who was related to the Inca kings. His name was Poma de Ayala. And he had oral testimony from soldiers who had actually fought in Florida. And when Ponce de Leon arrived there, he arrived like a conquistador. And I must tell you quickly how he arrived. It was the Taino pilots who showed him how to navigate those treacherous waters of the Bahamas. Bahama comes from Spanish Bahamar, the shallow sea. And then you anglicize it as Bahamas. So in there you can wreck your ships every second. And the Taino pilots, who were brilliant at navigation and at astronomy and at looking, the science of looking at the motion of waves and judging the distances from land, which, you know, only recently the Smithsonian had some white scholar discover that those black folks in the Pacific were navigating the entire Pacific Ocean in their catamaran boats, and they could look at the motion of the waves and the wind and tell the distances from land in that big, vast Pacific. So this is what the Tainos taught to Ponce de Leon, and he got past that Bahama current and he got to Florida. He immediately fell on the Native Americans and began slaughtering them after they welcomed him. These murderous Spanish and genocidal Spaniards. And what the Calusas did, they waited for him to come back. And then they feted, wined, and dined them for 4 days. And then they fell upon them and killed every single one. They left six alive, but barely alive. They wounded them so that the wound would work in enough time when they got back to Cuba to spread the word. Don't come back here. There's some serious folk here. And of course, they never learned, so they came back again. Ponce de Leon, we told, you know, he went to look for the Fountain of Youth. They ended his search with 6 days after he arrived in Cuba. He died from the wounds that the Calusas had put upon him. What that did for the Calusas, they learnt instantly the logistics of making special arrows that could neutralize the power of horses. They made special bows and arrows with special trajectories and force. And they would put their archers in the trees, and they could shoot an arrow right through the body of a horse. So when you read about how the Indians, you know, the Indians in quote, were terrified of horses, the Calusas dealt with the horses. And then with armor, after killing the Ponce de Leon fellows in armor, they took the armor, they stuffed it with straw, they hung it up on a tree, and they found every weak spot through which their spears and arrows could go. So when the Spaniards came back, they were ready for them. Yeah. They could take care of the armor, they could take care of the horses, and they were more brilliant tacticians in their own land. They could lure. So Alion goes next. And again, he went to a different part of the northern Florida coast. And when he was there, these Apalaches welcomed him, gave them food and drink. And then Alion invited about 300 of the Native Americans on the ships. And when they came aboard, they simply battened down the hatches and started taking them away as slaves. And every single one of them committed suicide before they got to Cuba, rather than face enslavement and this terrible act of treachery. And then Alion made the mistake of going back again. And this time they were ready for him. Once again they feted wine and dined. And they said to him, Alion, why are you fighting for this distant monarch across the sea? We are warriors, and we would have more respect for you if you came looking out for yourself and your people here. We could share some things with you and show you some techniques of surviving here. Anyway, when the Calusas were finished with Alion, he and about three others managed to get back to Puerto Rico. For 100 years, the Native Americans in Florida kept the European settlers at bay. You hear about Herman de Soto, how de Soto discovered the Mississippi. De Soto was utterly and totally defeated by those Native Americans. I'm telling you this because the tradition of resistance filtered into the blacks who were coming in now into Florida and who were going to write one of the great epic chapters of a struggle in the Colombian era. And you are told in the history books about two Seminole wars. The first, the blacks were called Seminoles. Then when the Creek Nation broke up and Sacafaca took his group over the border into Florida, these Creeks were called Seminoles. So there's no cohesive or logical Seminole. It was a word used to describe the people who had come into Florida from the north. And that alliance of the Native Americans and the Africans in Florida held in spite of every effort to break it. You heard about Osceola. Many black people call their children Osceola. Osceola married a black woman. And when he went to have talks with Thompson, General Thompson, at the Fort Gaines, slave catchers captured his wife, and his wife in the Seminole language was called Cochicher, which means morning dew. And this sister was a fighter, because the slave catcher who took her, the news came out after that she killed him and committed suicide. But Osceola swore that he would avenge this black woman's capture. And Thompson, the general, he and his men followed him for 2 years. And one night after Thompson had a good dinner and was coming out of his veranda, they filled him with about 14 shots from their rifles. And Osceola, after he fell, shouted, you know, "I remember the hour," he said. So we have to remember ours too, you see. No black woman was ever defended in a war in this hemisphere until Osceola fought. He fought, the first Seminole War was fought over that capture of Cochiteer. And amongst these groups, you know, you know how we get the research about the Seminole Wars? You have to go to New England, into the libraries, and into the parish records. And there are letters from white soldiers who were fighting in Florida, who wrote home about what was happening. Because it was a felony for any journalist to mention that blacks were fighting in Florida. That's why you don't know about it. And that fight went on, and amongst the great leaders who emerged was Abraham. He is one of the great black leaders in this North American history. All of the whites who write about Abraham, even though they hate him, write about him with respect. Abraham was a brilliant man, a brilliant fighter, a brilliant tactician. He knew several languages, and he was one of the chief negotiators. See, while the Spanish owned Florida, Abraham knew that they could stay free. But when the United States bought Florida in 1819, they knew now that the whole might of the United States was going to be turned against them. And that's exactly what happened. By the late 1840s, two-thirds of all the United States armed forces were fighting against black and Seminole insurgents in Florida. Two-thirds. Over 50,000 troops. It's the greatest war in which the U.S. fought until Vietnam. And Abraham at one point called his followers together and said, "We are fighting for the liberation of all oppressed peoples in this hemisphere. We will never sign a treaty with our enemies." And the whole nation had to vote. And one faction voted that they would sign a treaty. And Abraham and Atlasa, or Tiger Cat, he was called in the Coacochi, in the Seminole language, which means Tiger Cat. He was Abraham's counterpart among the Native Americans. And they left Florida when the whole, after defeating over and over again some of the mightiest of the armies the U.S. had mounted, including now Schlesinger, that historian, writes a biography of Jackson, Andrew Jackson, Stonewall Jackson. Do you know that the blacks in Florida wasted Jackson? He fought at Suwannee. There, that small town, Suwannee is a Seminole word, which means the river of reeds. And there, Atlasa and Abraham met Jackson's forces, and Abraham begged for the right to be the first to attack them. So he held the right wing, and they tore to pieces Jackson's forces. And he was frothing with rage. Here were blacks who he believed were inferior, and And the tactics, some of the tactics they used, they played on Jackson's racism. They sent some blacks in front to look as though they were minstrels. They were chewing and playing banjo and jiving around. And so Jackson let his guard down, you know, so he's coming on now to wipe these blacks off the face of the earth. And right there in those hammocks were waiting the highly trained troops of Abraham. And Jackson now, to take his revenge, this is not, you're not going to find that in your history book by Schlesinger, but this is a fact. He went to the settlement where they had left the women and children, and there he fell upon them and slaughtered them. And the history books tell you he won a great victory. And Abraham and his troops and his Seminole comrades had disappeared. And Jackson's advisors told him, if you want to be president of the United States, there are some really bad blacks here in Florida, and they will ruin your reputation to such a point you never make it to the presidency. So get out of here now. And he left, and he didn't come back. So here... Then Abraham and Atlasa took their whole communities to Oklahoma. And there once again they tried to trick them. They kept their arms, they never gave up their arms. And when they saw that once again they're being surrounded and tricked, I'm giving you a very encapsulated history, and I want you to go away feeling better. They fought from Oklahoma all the way into southern Mexico, into northern Mexico, in Coahuila, that border state, where there were about 3,000 black maroons already to welcome them. They had escaped from the slavery in Texas and those border states. And Atlasa and Abraham lived there with their communities. Now the Texas legislature felt you couldn't have blacks like this, of such renowned fighters, living across the border while the slave system is still rampant in this country. So these macho Texas Rangers now set out to go and finish off these blacks. The only reports I have of that is a Texas paper which says the two expeditions that went returned with their numbers greatly reduced. And Abraham died in bed, you know, there in Coyne, near a town called Santa Rosa on that Mexican border. And if you go there, I have been there, you can see the descendants of those black Seminoles. You know, you can't hide the features and the blood. It shows. And there you see these larger folk who are ranchers and living there still. And they were given land and freedom by Juarez, the first Native American president of Mexico. He's a full-blooded Indian. Juarez. He gave to these black fighters because...
Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. Yankuru basically correcting the record and creating an official record, an authentic record, of the cooperative efforts of African slaves and Native Americans in resisting the effort to enslave them all. And it's a lesson for us. It's a lesson for us, and I hope that it encourages you to go do some more reading. This is really the purpose of Black History Month, to broaden and deepen your view of history. There are people out there who have worked very hard to provide it, spent years of research in far-flung places around the world to get it, and now it's up to us. When we talk about Black History Month, and, you know, people think, well, you know, you just talk about, you know, you talk about a particular person and two lines after that, you're done, and you would have had Black history. No. Make an effort. Get to know Black history. And this is for everybody. Because many, too many of our historical records are utterly inaccurate, wrong, and need to be corrected. Despite the many obstacles, we have had historians who painstakingly and at their own expense have gone through the process of locating facts and putting them in books so that we can read them, all of us can read them. So I encourage you to do that in this Black History Month. If we really do believe that we have a shared history, and there's a history that we do not know because the underlying message to that history is that people weren't spending so much time fighting each other as they were in trying to cooperate with each other where they saw common interests. And this is such a case. Thanks for joining me today, and we'll see each other tomorrow, same time. Bye-bye.